Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Today is Wednesday, April 18th. And first in the studio, we have the school board representative, Petra Butler, along with our district communications director, Melinda Colton. Good morning. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
We're here to talk about, well, let's start off with the announcement about the interim superintendent made last night at the school board meeting. That was after a very long session of, maybe 3 hours discussing some of the candidates for the superintendent position. But who would like to start with that as far as the interim announcement?
Yes, it was an exciting announcement. It was a decision that was made between Dr. Connolly and the board. It was an agreement that we needed some leadership in order to move forward. Dr. Connolly is now focusing on the new position that she has in Mesa, Arizona, and she came to the board with concerns about leadership in the district, and a consensus was made by the board with agreement that we place an interim in place. Dr. Connolly would still be available to provide any necessary information to our interim superintendent, who is now Dave Gomez, so that we continue to have the district move forward in the way it has been.
Okay, and Dave comes from Parley's Park.
Yes.
He was the principal there. And so what happens in Parley's Park? You've assigned an interim principal, I presume.
Absolutely. Okay. Tracy Fike is now going to be the acting principal at Parley's Park Elementary. She's very well respected, and she's a true asset at that school.
And what is Tracy's background?
Tracy has an MBA, as well as being a teacher. She was the instructional coach, and we're very excited that she's chosen to accept that position.
Okay, and one of the comments in the release, Melinda, the press release that you provided, said that I guess Mr. Gomez wanted to address some particular issues over these next couple of months. Can you highlight what that might be, what he was referring to?
I think what he's really talking about mostly is consistency, so that we have someone that's in place that can make these decisions, and that relieves Dr. Connolly then of having to worry about what's going on here and then also trying to transition to her new place. So he may personally have some other things that he'd like to maybe work on, but it's kind of the end of the year, and so there's a lot of things that are in place right now. We're in the throes of testing, end-of-year testing, and those kinds of things. So I think he's going to get in and really help us get some decisions made. There's a lot of signatures that are required for a lot of documents, and those are all the kinds of things that our current superintendent won't have to worry about.
Okay, and is Dave Gomez, is he a candidate for the final position of superintendent, or is this strictly an interim? Has he submitted his application?
Right now, so this is only on the interim basis. Last night, if you want to move into the next section,
sure,
we can talk about the 2.5 hours that we spent talking. So we narrowed the pool of candidates. We had between 30 and 40 candidates for the position, which is unbelievable.
That's great.
It was very exciting. And we've narrowed the position down to less than 10. Unfortunately, I can't give you the exact number because the folks have yet to be notified. And so I don't want to give an exact number, but it's less than 10. And how we're going to move forward with this process is we're starting a community committee of both the community as well as teachers. It'll be a 10-person committee. We'll have 5 from the school district and 5 from the community at large. There is an email out already, and I'll have Melinda fill in a little bit. We have an email out already that we're soliciting for the 5 members from the school district, and we're soliciting for 5 members from the community. And it's really important to the board to get a very good cross-section of our community. We want that panel to represent the demographics that we have within our community. It's a very simple process. You just reply to the email that has gone out. It's got 3 or 4 questions on it. The first question being something like, why is it that you would like to participate in this committee? And the responses need to go back to the board president, Andrew Kaplan, by Monday, the 23rd at 5 p.m.
And have you received any applications so far?
I believe we have, yes.
Okay.
And they can get to that, Carolyn, for those that in the community that are not parents and don't have access to email necessarily. They can get to that through the website if you will just actually click on pcschools.org. US, and at the very top right-hand corner is news. Takes into the newsroom. All the questions are listed there. Mr. Kaplan's email address is listed, so they can send a resume and also answer those questions, and that gives the board an idea of kind of the dynamics of what they want that makeup to be for that committee.
Right. Okay. And the time frame that's associated with that, there'll be an orientation if you wish to be part of that committee. It'll be May 4th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m.
It's a Friday night.
It's a Friday night, absolutely. And then the interviews will actually take place on Saturday, and it will be all day, probably from about 8 in the morning till about 6 in the evening.
Yeah, so with the interviewing process, will those interviews be public, open to the public?
They will not. So it's a two-part process. There will actually be the committee will do an hour of interviews with each of the candidate, and then the board will actually conduct a separate one-hour interview with each of the candidates.
And will the committee be interviewing as a 10-person committee, or will they be breaking up into smaller groups? Or
no, it'll be a 10-person committee, and the questions that are going to be asked by the committee will be selected by the committee themselves. The board met yesterday and decided on the questions that the board will be asking each of the candidates.
And are you able to disclose whether there are any internal candidates in that final, whatever, 10 or so
Not
applicants?
Not as of yet, because they haven't been notified yet. The notifications will go out today, so I don't want to make any comments on that.
Okay. And as far as the steps after the interview, so all of these semi-finalists, I guess, will they fly into town, or?
Yes, so they will fly into town. They'll fly in the day before the interviews and fly out probably the day after the interviews, depending on when their time frame is. The board will meet with the community members and have a discussion and do the rankings. And then the subsequent interviews will actually take place on May 18th for any finalists that we have.
Okay.
Because I think, Carolyn, it's going to be really important, because those interviews are on a Saturday. These final candidates will most likely want to visit schools, kind of get the makeup of the district, and they'll get a little bit of personality from the committee that interviews them as well as the board members. But I think it's important for them, especially to meet the very people that they'll be supervising, which is your district office, your principals, your cabinet, and then another chance to meet with the board.
So have the recruiting consultants, have they done background checks on the preliminaries, or how does that work?
Yes, so they have. They vetted each of the candidates. That was part of the discussion that we had yesterday. The final candidates will have the very in-depth background checks conducted. That is a company that we will actually pay to do a further in-depth investigation with regard to each of the candidates.
Okay, and just to get back to the appointment of Dave Gomez mm-hmm. to this position, was this the kind of situation that opened up for, like, applicants to apply for the interim, or was it a situation where it was just a person was tapped to do it?
Well, actually, we've had conversations with Dr. Connolly about this. Dr. Connolly brought forth a list of names to the board that she would recommend as an interim superintendent, and Mr. Gomez was one of the names that was brought forward.
Okay. And that decision was basically made last night in the closed session also?
Yes, but we actually had a formal process in the open session where we nominated him, and it was a unanimous decision to have him selected as the interim.
I see.
And typically, okay. Carolyn, school boards, it's in their purview to appoint someone, especially where it's this so quick, and working with the superintendent. It's not something that you would necessarily ask people to apply for, because he could be there as long as July or maybe through August, depending on when the selected candidate for the superintendent can come on board.
Okay. Let's move into the school improvement plans. They're known as the SIPs.
Yes.
And each of the school leaders made a presentation to the board last night. And I'm kind of curious, are there a lot of different things happening in the schools this year compared to, say, last year, as far as their particular goals and what they're striving for?
No, if you actually listened and you heard what they said, many of them are very, very similar. It's just we want to increase the achievement of our students. They've done fabulous, and we just want to continue on that same trajectory. And so many of those things that were being asked for and discussed were just to continue on that same line, whether it was in the area of mathematics or language arts or science.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the Utah School Land Trust plans, this is something that's done every year about this time of the year. It's required by state statute that it be provided. And it also involved the community council members. And tell us a little bit about how they have become involved in that process, because we haven't had community council members for, what, longer than maybe 10 right. years or so?
Interestingly, I'll take that one, Patrick, because I am actually a school committee council chair at my own school district where my sons attend in Draper. And so I've been doing this a couple years now, and I learned an awful lot in the last few years. But the school community council is their primary responsibility from the legislature is to determine where that land trust money goes. And so like at my school district, for example, we had almost $160,000 just for one middle school. And that's a pretty large middle school. So our schools can get anywhere from that money from 50, 60, 70,000 all the way up to maybe 150,000 here in Park City. And so the school community council, their primary responsibility is to work with the school principal and that leadership team to develop the school improvement plan. And then that trust land money is used to help fund how we're going to do those improvements. So it's incredibly wonderful money that comes in from those lands, that public lands that we have here in Utah.
And is the allocation of funding by school or is it by district?
It's by school based upon size, enrollment.
Okay, it's a headcount thing.
It is, yes.
Okay, great. And did you see anything that were like real standouts as far as really, you know, extreme stretches for any of the schools? And I mean, I heard some pretty high
lofty
numbers.
Goals.
Yes, some lofty goals yes. were presented last night.
I think the only struggle that some of the schools have to focus on is we have to take the data from last year and forecast for next year because we haven't got to the end of testing yet. And so I think that's something that we might look at again in August to make sure that some of those numbers are actually viable as we move forward. And it's just a little bit of a stretch because they do have to take the old data to look towards the new data.
So the state put out a report card, and I believe this is done on a random basis. Mm-hmm. The schools around the state in fifth and eighth grade are tested. And one of the areas that continues to be a big challenge, and I think it is for Park City as well, is this achievement gap issue. Mm-hmm. Where are we on that, and how is that part of what's addressed in the goal setting process? Is that kind of across the board something that everybody's looking at?
Oh, absolutely. And if you heard specifically, I mean, there are dollars that are being designated specifically to address that achievement gap, whether it's through additional services for after school programs, whether it's those summer school programs, whether it's bringing in reading aids to assist. I mean, there's a multitude of issues that were discussed last night that will specifically address the achievement gap.
I mean, it's a bit of a national issue. I mean, it certainly is a state issue.
Absolutely.
And the numbers that I saw, at least from this report, show that the national averages for achievement gap are, I mean, it's not so great. And I just wonder, are there model districts out there of successes that we look at or that we consider?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's one of the things that we're going to focus on when we're bringing in this new superintendent. Mm-hmm. With Kathleen Einhorn leaving, somebody to focus on that curriculum issue to help close that achievement gap. These are two very top issues that need to be resolved. And it's a big focus for us as we move forward.
Okay, great. And then there were, oh boy, lots of policies for posting.
Tis the season yes. for that, Carolyn.
Oh, I had to leave. But do you want to tell us anything about the dropout and retention recovery programs? Because I thought that was kind of an interesting issue. And I just wonder how big of an issue is it in our district?
It's not a big issue in our district, not at all, but it's a policy that's mandated that we have.
So it's a new policy.
It is, and it's just something that we keep tabs on.
Okay. Anything else about the meeting?
I think it was a great meeting. I'm so excited to move forward with the master planning. We had the opportunity to meet with MVP, the program, MV5, that we're bringing on board. We're looking forward to that. We're looking forward to moving forward with the new superintendent. And I just want to remind all the listeners today that there is a information exchange with board members from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock today at Trailside. So please join us. It'll be myself and Ann Peters.
And then I presume at the next board meeting, budgets will be brought up again. We kind of had a little hiatus last night on budget talks. So
you've still been working out. They've still been scanning the data and really digging deep into that to make sure that they're spending their money where it can get the most benefits from.
And are we close to finalizing that? Because I know there are schools administrators that are waiting for confirmations on hiring and...
Right, but a lot of those positions the board has already agreed to move forward with, especially a lot of those teacher positions, because now is the prime time to be hiring. There's a couple questions that still need to be resolved with regard to the interventionist. We've asked for some additional information. So, yes, this next budget meeting will be a big one.
Okay, getting close. All right, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Us.
Okay, bye now. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Thank you for joining us. Good morning. It's KPCW News Time, 8:30. This is the Local News Hour. We've got our next guest, Anne Laurent from the city. She is the
Community Development Director.
Pardon me. And we have Diane Foster, who is the city manager. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, good morning, Carol. And how are you?
They're here to give us an update on, or a preview on the meeting coming up tomorrow. So, land use and building permits, customer service. This has been a topic that I guess was discussed very thoroughly at the retreat. And there were or are some plans underway to make the whole building permitting process more user-friendly. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a background on that and just what's happening in terms of any changes being made.
Absolutely. And this is something we've been working on for a little while, probably a couple years now, and have known as a top priority, and that is to use technology to better help our workflows and tracking of our permit processes. And so we went and through a selection process, and then we've been working through the technical aspects of migrating all of our existing permit data into a new system, as well as how we take in the financial piece and how we make that work with our financial system. So we do have a signed contract for permit software called My City Inspector. It should be one that at least some of the contractors are familiar with if they do work in Wasatch County, because they've been using it for several years now. It does have a new function where it's not just inspection software, but it's actually plan review, electronic plan review. And so some of the highlights are that it will allow people to submit their application and plans electronically, be able to see what the status of them are electronically, receive notifications electronically of review comments, as well as real-time inspections. The inspectors will have tablets out in the field, and there's more too, but we're very excited to finally come up to speed with what other municipalities are doing there. And then from there, we want to certainly track and report out on our information more accurately, more frequently, and implement customer service feedback. As each user uses the process, they can go in and give us some feedback, and then we'll be using that to come back to council and talking a little bit more specifically about what we think the concerns are. We have certainly understand on a one-on-one basis individual issues would happen, but I think we are doing so much, the volume has been tremendous over the last year, and so it's going to give us a better assessment of where we might be able to make some improvements to continue the path of just an ongoing, hey, we can always do something better.
And how's your staff coping with the new changes and using this electronic system versus the face-to-face that I guess has been kind of part of the building permitting process for a long time now?
Right. I think the face-to-face is probably going to be harder to give up for our customer probably than our staff, because I feel like they have a hard time managing getting some of their work done due to the high amount of face-to-face that we do. But we're not going to take it away. That will still be there. We're going to have a transition period. We're going to have trainings. We're going to have a kiosk right by our counter so we can help people out. But staff was a big part of actually selecting the software. We took the time to involve staff and figuring out what would really be something they would use and what would they really view as being helpful to them, rather than them fighting the system and feeling like it's not working for them. They have to be able to view it as something that's helpful.
Are there any particular codes or systems that the city has that are causing problems in the system at this point, or gumming things up?
So it doesn't always report out the way we would like to. It's a little bit cumbersome, and it was not necessarily intended to be a permit process software. It's a more global financial software. And so this is more of a specialized software that was actually designed by someone who was working in a permit office and said, you know what, I can do better than this, and then found a couple IT architects to help her create her own software. So sometimes we just don't feel like the system's very efficient and helpful for us, and it doesn't communicate as easily as we would like with our customers in terms of automatic emails and things like that, and being able to schedule inspections online. And
I know that your staff has been really pressed in terms of the workload, and that's been a concern for a long time, but do you anticipate that this should ease things up a little bit, or do you anticipate you're going to have to hire even more people because you're going to be that much more efficient and you're taking on that many more building permits?
I do believe it'll help us be more efficient. I think we spend a lot of time trying to track things down and track the status of things. I think our customer spends a lot of time going office to office trying to figure out where they are in the process. And so I truly believe that as people start to use the process and the software and start to trust that it's giving them accurate information, hopefully it'll free up the hand-holding and the checking in that the customer feels they have to do right now, because they can automatically know. And we feel like it helps us be more efficient in our communications. But we also don't see the demand on the actual workload itself going down. We see some really big projects on the horizon. So we are also looking at staffing and doing some training programs to make sure that we have, you know, we're sort of building our staff up both in plan review and inspection, and growing staff from within to make sure that we've always got somebody coming up to fill positions. But yes, it's a lot of work.
What are those big projects on the horizon that you're referring to?
Well, certainly the resorts, and certainly we've been talking to a lot of different people in our housing projects and some of the community center, just to name a few. But there's a lot that are still going on.
A lot going on, yeah. Is there like a goal that you have in mind as far as, from start to finish, you know, being able to provide a permit so that your customers, the builders and developers, can sort of know a timeline or at least have a sense of what to expect?
Well, we already have some of those in place. For instance, our goals are always next day inspections. If you call in by 2:00, you get a next day inspections. If we are for some reason having a staffing problem, we usually notify people that it's going to be more than 24 hours on inspection. For plan review, the state actually has mandated some time frames on residential review, so it's 14 days. And so we're already under those kind of time frames. But the piece of it that's a little bit we want to make more efficient for the customer is getting it when there's missing information, or they need to correct something, or if there's a, notification to say, hey, you need to give us this or we can't move it forward. That's the piece of it that right now is not as efficient as it could be. And then also the land use approvals. A lot of times with plats and other conditions of approval, we need to make sure those are all in place before we can even do building permits. So those are some of the places where we would like to be more efficient with our communication and have our customer understand more quickly what their situation is and what to expect is in front of them.
Okay. Anything else you want to add on this topic?
No, just that we would welcome any feedback, and it's not an easy business to be in regulation, but I think we can certainly do it in a way where people understand it better, and that's our goal.
Excellent. Okay, and let's move on to the Olympic bid update, Diane.
Sure.
2030, I guess, is the timeline. And my understanding is the IOC has a two-stage process.
They do. Their two-stage process is first they go in and have an informal dialogue with cities who are interested in bidding, and then you become a formal candidate. So far, there have been three U.S. cities that have expressed interest in the Winter Games for 2030, and that's Denver, Reno/Tahoe area, and then Salt Lake City, of which Park City would be a featured part.
So we, as a community, already are struggling with housing and parking issues. We've got the Olympics, if they're truly a possibility. We would need more employees, more volunteers. I know the state really is, you know, the state seems to be very much in favor of soliciting this event, but would it really be a thing that Park City needs to be part of? I mean, do we need more recognition?
So this isn't about recognition. This is about the Olympic spirit, and I think the Olympic spirit is alive and well in Park City, as we saw from the parade on Main Street. And we have the fact that USSA is headquartered here, the fact that we have the Utah Olympic Park and then Soldier Hollow just down in Midway. I mean, it's an amazing place for Olympians, and this is really about supporting them and supporting the youth in the community who look to being Olympians. And, you know, when you think about, you know, I remember 2002 Olympics, I went to Costco. I spent $500 on groceries because I had lots of house guests, and I thought, I'll never get to the grocery store. And as you'll remember, it was actually easier to go to the grocery store than most weekends when the ski resorts are letting out, right? This town knows how to mitigate impacts, and we're really good at it. And so I personally look forward to it just because it's a really exciting time, and I do think it's good for our community. And one of the things that I do think is good, and that we've already had some sit-downs with Fraser Bullock, who's leading up the process for the state of Utah, and also with Colin Hilton, and is their approach is very much they want it to be symbiotic. What could the Olympics do for us, and what can Park City do for the Olympics? Well, I think the answer to the second question is obvious. We're a great venue community. Colin Hilton and his team have done a great job keeping up the facilities at Soldier Hollow, as well as at the Utah Olympic Park and the Oval down in Salt Lake. And that's not normal, right? Most places don't keep up their facilities like that. So this would provide funding for further upkeep and upgrades. And then as a community, we would, as you'll see in the staff report, there are a number of upcoming opportunities for the public to participate in discussions around, well, what would be good for Park City? What would be things that would be we'll be testing for the 2019 World Championship. We'll be testing, we're hoping to test a bus system that goes directly to Salt Lake City. So to the airport, sorry, we already have 16 runs a day to Salt Lake City, but now the opportunity to go directly to the airport is one opportunity. There are lots of opportunities, and I think a lot of benefits that we can have from the Olympics, in addition to it being just a great way to show our Olympic spirit.
And is there a potential increase and focus on affordable housing and expanding transit and that type of thing? Because as it is now, when we do have big events, it's often, you know, pretty much a gridlock. I mean, we've had that on multiple occasions throughout this winter, and even this was a winter where it wasn't, you know, wasn't a super, super heavy snow year. But are these opportunities for the state and the county and the city to advance affordable housing and make it so that we do have, you know, places where employees can live and work and not be, you know, traveling in their single use vehicles, that type of thing?
That's absolutely a possibility. And I do want to say that we actually technically have not had gridlock since Carmageddon. So one of the things that we've done, and we now treat peak days as completely normal. So whether it's Sundance or whether it's a peak ski day, we have an operational plan that we execute for every one of those peak ski days, which includes posting police officers at the four major intersections. And so what that does is that keeps people from, at a yellow light, pulling into the intersection because they're frustrated. So it technically prevents gridlock. I'm not saying that we don't have traffic. We definitely do have traffic, and we're continuing to work on it. But I think most folks in town that have talked to me have indicated that they felt like traffic this year during Sundance was better than ever. And I think you know that the measures we took during the Olympics was even a little bit greater than that. And as far as affordable housing, that would be one of the things that, as the city's critical priorities, we would look at those of affordable housing, transportation, energy, and social equity, and say, what are the opportunities that under those that we could bring during this. In fact, when we talked with Fraser Bullock and Colin Hilton, we talked about the city's critical priorities, and they thought it meshed well with the objectives of the IOC.
Okay. New business, we've got on the agenda the purchase of the Cook Drive property, 1995. Now, why is staff recommending this purchase? Is there a designation for what this will be used for, or what's the background on that?
I'll let Ann take that one.
Okay. So this is probably, I think it's the fourth unit that we, well, maybe it's the third or fourth, that we've purchased, and what we're doing is updating the deed restrictions. So it's currently a deed-restricted unit, and we're updating the deed restrictions, and then we put them back out in the market. This particular unit is in Cook Drive, where the city already has four or five units. And so we are looking to potentially hold on to it to house some transit staff, because we are in critical need housing our transit staff. But we're going to have that conversation, and we're going to have a kind of a more global housing policy conversation with council on the May 3rd. Is that the next meeting?
Mm-hmm.
And get some direction on if there's, we're trying to try to figure out how to update deed restrictions, maybe without purchasing and reselling them. And then we're also going to figure out, do we need more stock of our own for the city staff?
So the city manages now five properties? Is that what you said?
I want to say it's four.
Four.
Cook Drive.
Okay.
Yes.
And why is why are transit employees the focus on this? I mean, why would there not be other employee housing projects that you're trying to
develop? So we do house other employees in the Cook Drive units, but we are at a critical point with transit housing. So that's why that's been our focus, is because when it comes to the fall, November, we're going to need a place to put a lot of seasonal transit drivers. We are in the process of also looking at other options for transit, but they're in process. So until those are in place, we're still kind of scraping what we can together.
Okay.
And
great.
I think it's impressive that the city is taking its own responsibility as either the third or fourth largest employer. I think we're the fourth largest employer in town. We're well below the ski resorts, but it is important that we take that responsibility seriously, and the ability to have housing. We ran 20 drivers short all winter long, and that's a significant, in the transit department we have about 175 staff total, and running 20 drivers short is a huge impact on the system. It's tough on the drivers. We're so pleased with how the winter went, despite the fact that we were short. But you look out to the future, and, housing prices here are pretty crazy. And then you look at Aspen, and we're not even close to where Aspen's at. So I don't, pending, the bubble bursting, I don't foresee that housing prices are going to do anything. And even in a recession, Park City housing prices haven't taken the hit that other communities have had.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much. That's Diane Foster, City Manager, and Anne Laurent, Community Development Director. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Our next guest is Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright and the Park City Fire District Fire Marshal Mike Owens. Thank you for coming in. They're here to talk about the Project for Deeper Understanding and the age or era of mega wildfires.
Good morning.
So we've got an interesting conversation coming up for the Project for Deeper Understanding tomorrow evening, 7:00, St. Luke's Episcopal Church.
Correct.
And, recent years, we have seen some enormous fires, catastrophic fires. I mean, you just Google, wildfires from 2017, and it's just staggering. The Thomas Fire, the Santa Rosa fires, 42 people died, $1 billion in losses, that type of thing. So what are we hoping to get out of this conversation on Thursday?
I've raised the issue because I want to get the public aware of what the hazards may be coming into this fire season. With a low snowpack, we're going to have probably much drier environment coming in through this summer. We are higher danger for a large forest fire. And we have some parts of the county where we've what's called the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface. Think Summit Park and places like that, where houses have been built right into the trees. The Santa Rosa fire really got my attention. last year when we saw what happened there. They weren't particularly close to where the fire started, and it completely took out that town.
Yeah.
And that could happen here unless we start taking some active measures to protect the houses in Niue. But then beyond that, we've got issues of forest management in the national forest. The other issue I'm really concerned about is the Bryan Head fire from last year, which really trashed a watershed in that part of the state. So we're going to be breaking up the conversation into both of those areas. How do we protect our citizens in the Niue, and what can we do to promote better forest management that might prevent a serious hit on our forests and our water infrastructure?
Okay. And Mike, so it's almost inconceivable how a town of 8,000, structures can be just burned up. What's happening? What's actually going on? How does that happen?
So the biggest thing we have to remember is that we live in a system. A small change somewhere is going to end up being a large change somewhere else. As homeowners and as residents here, one of the things we need to do is really protect our space so that when something happens, we don't want to be the one to cause those problems. So we start looking at things like defensible space around your home. When we don't have trees directly over our house, if something happens to our house, it doesn't spread somewhere else. 8,000 people isn't a lot of people for as big of an area as we cover. But, when we work together, we can make such a tremendous difference. It makes a big difference in the end.
Yeah. Is it just defensible areas, or are there other behavioral things that residents and citizens need to start to, think about seriously? I mean, you hear about, fireworks being banned, yet all through the month of July, they're going off all over the place.
So there's a funny... Talk to sociologists. There's a funny theory that applies to humans, and it won't happen to me. I won't be the cause of the problem. I'm going to go ahead and do this, or I've done this for this many number of years, and it's never been a problem. And you're right. When fireworks are banned, or fire pits are banned, open burns aren't allowed, there's reasons for that, whether it be a weather reason, such as the winds. We may see winds coming in that are a little higher than normal, or the ground is a little drier than we expect it to be. We don't look at what's happening today, tomorrow, and the next day. We look at what's happening months down the line. So when we say, hey, we need to put a fire restriction in place, there's reasoning behind it. The national forecasts right now are saying that July is going to be a little bit worse than normal for us. And anyone who's been here for any period of time knows that July is already pretty rough to begin with.
Yeah, so we had an early season fire happen out by Strawberry. Was it a tanker truck? And some of the comments made from the firefighting teams that were out there addressing that were really concerned that it was such an early season kind of accident that really took off. I mean,
there was one out by Wanship also.
Another, yeah.
We did have a wildland fire out by Wanship that was controlled in a pretty good amount of time. And it is surprising to see fires happen this early in the year. This year we are expecting an earlier season than normal, and it will probably go a little later than normal as well. This is going to be a tough season, and we will really depend on the citizens of our area here to do their part. It's very important. We have programs in place that will help them to help themselves, and I can't stress how big of a deal that's going to be.
And the discussion on Thursday night, there will be a number of experts on the panel. Glenn, do you want to talk a little bit
sure.
about them?
Sure. We've got a really powerful panel coming in Thursday night. From the county, Bryce Boyer, our county fire marshal, Chris Carr, our emergency preparedness manager, Darren McAvoy, who is an assistant wildland resources professor at the USU, works with national forest issues. John Blazard, the last sawmill operator in Eastern Summit County. One of the issues we have with the national forest is the lumbering industry has been devastated economically over the last several decades. In talking to the district forest ranger, who will also be here, a guy named Daniel Haragai, he mentioned to me that the amount of wood that they timber that they have out for bid this year, we can probably only handle about 10% of that within Summit County. So, you know, the economic consequences of decades of lack of lumbering in the national forest has been an issue. Of course, Mike will be there, and I just got a new recruit yesterday who asked to participate, a guy named Ryan Torsicolo. I hope I pronounced his name right, because I just got an inquiry from him on the via email, and he's part of Wasatch Arborists, who has done some forest clearing in the past.
Is it realistic to think that the federal or forest management programs can really be affected by Summit County? Or
we can hopefully affect our local program to a degree. And I think it's going to be a long-term project. I think we're going to have to do some lobbying with state, with Congress, to get more money for forest health, clearing out the deadfall. And the ladder fuels in the forest is a big issue for forest management. It's not going to be a simple process. We certainly don't have the money in Summit County's budget to supplement the Forest Service. But I read an article recently from Summit County, Colorado. They had a wildfire a year or two ago there that fortunately at the last minute the wind changed and it burned itself out. But Breckenridge was definitely in danger for a few hours. As a result of that, the Denver Water Department has put in millions of dollars to start to aid in forest management programs there, because that's their watershed. So those are some things we may need to start talking to other governmental bodies about, because it's a problem that can affect everybody. The Weber Basin watershed supplies water to 600,000 people. A Brian Head-type fire in the Summit County part of the National Forest could have a devastating impact on the water supply for 400,000 to 600,000 people.
Yeah, pretty big impact. Mike, what to talk a little bit about the conditions for this past winter. Just our snowpack was very low. It didn't, press down the growth, the old growth from last year, so that's still standing tall. You're going to have new growth coming in. We've had a fairly wet spring, I guess, which potentially creates even more fuel when the hot, dry winds do start. So what is it, do we have a sort of a critical mass going here?
We are getting to the point where it could be a big problem. We know that, like you said, those grasses, they didn't get pushed down, and so our fuels, we have more fuels than we normally would expect. This is why we are going to depend on the citizens here so much, because we can't. Our firefighters are incredible. We can get out there. We can put those fires out. Those ground fires that start in the grass, we'll get out there and we'll hit those things with everything we have. If they burn too fast, or if they get in the trees too fast, then that's where we will start to see problems. So you say critical mass. We are going to be pretty close to that point. You know, we're going to ask people to use their heads. Fireworks have been restricted by the state legislature already. We may see greater restrictions there. Campfires, if you have fire pits around your home, make sure you are using those spark arresters on them. Smoking on the trails, not the greatest idea out there. We've had a fire already in town from that one a couple of years ago. So there are things out there it's going to make a big difference this year.
What were the causes of the just massive fires in California? Were they human caused?
One of the hardest things about fire investigation, and especially wildland fire investigation, it's easy to pinpoint where the fire started, but it gets to be very difficult to find the reason why. A lot of those are still undetermined.
Okay.
But
well,
we know that
you.
A significant number of those fires are human caused. Right. The Brian Head fire certainly was.
So we've got to wrap it up now. Let's just give a quick reminder, 7 o'clock at the St. Luke's Episcopal Church Project for a Deeper Understanding. KPCW will be simulcasting that event, and you expect it'll be a couple hours long.
7 to 9.
And opportunities for people to ask questions and participate. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Mike Owens and Glenn Wright. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to